Now, I'd like to welcome, as we start with Rachel Horman, who joins us by video link. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
The lead MLC is Mrs. Lord Brennan, and she is sitting next to me. Ms. Horman, could I ask, first of all, for the record, for you to identify yourself and then go on if you wish to make any opening statement. Thank you.
Yes, my name is Rachel Horman. I'm a solicitor in Lancashire, in England. I specialise in family law in the main, in particular in relation to domestic abuse, coercive control, and stalking. I've practiced in this area for 20 years now. I'm also the chair of Paladin, which is the National Stalking Advocacy Service, who represent and advocate on behalf of high-risk stalking victims throughout England and Wales.
Thank you very much. Would you like to make any further opening statement before I call on the honourable member to ask the first question?
No, not at this stage.
Thank you very much. In that case, I invite Mrs. Lord Brennan to ask her first question.
Thank you, Mr. President, and thank you very much, Rachel, for agreeing to talk to the Legislative Council today and to help our consideration in the Domestic Abuse Bill as part of this committee. First of all, turning to the topic of stalking, could you explain what risks are presented with not including stalking in this bill?
Yeah, that was one of the first things that I noticed about the bill, that I was surprised that it didn't contain stalking. I think Northern Ireland this morning have announced that they will include stalking and that they will have a stalking law. It's something that they've been talking about for quite some time. And in England, certainly, we've noticed that when we had the stalking law from 2012, it's certainly led to an increase in reporting, and we found that before then, the only legislation we had in England and Wales was harassment, and I understand that you also have a criminal offence of harassment. But in my view, that's very different to stalking. Mm-hmm. And I think if you were to be faced with two people, one with a conviction for harassment and one with a conviction for stalking, I think you would be much more concerned about stalker, and quite rightly, because they are two very different crimes. Harassment, really, was often used to deal with much lower level type behaviour. Things like disputes between neighbours about the size of a hedge, for example, and that kind of thing, whereas stalking is very different. It's very dangerous and often leads to homicide. So I do think they need to be treated very differently and named very differently. I think most people who are being stalked would not be going to call it harassment. Stalking is about fixation and obsession, whereas harassment isn't. The other thing that I think is important is that there is a distinction in terms of sentencing with regard to the two crimes, because stalking is far more serious than harassment. And when you look at domestic violence homicides, in virtually every single one, there's been stalking in the run-up to the homicide. So if we can sort out the stalking, we can effectively prevent the homicides, in my view, and I think that is really important. So I would encourage you to consider having a specific offence of stalking, because I think it switches on the police's mind to that behaviour when you use that word, and I think it's important that we call it what it is. The other thing about it is that your current bill, whilst I realise some elements of it could cover stalking behaviour, that would associated persons that have been connected to each other in a domestic violence context, it wouldn't cover straight up stalking. And that again is something that's massively on the increase, and again can go on for many years. And we've seen with the advent of Twitter, I'm sure you yourselves have had some experience of unwanted contacts on Twitter, and perhaps threats or being followed, etc. That's on the increase. And with the case in England of Joe Cox, which I'm sure you're aware about, I think it's something that really should be on the agenda to look at protecting people who aren't associated with their stalker. And it may be a stranger, but it's still very unwanted. The newsreader Emily Maitlis, for example, has been in the news recently. She's been stalked by her stalker for over 20 years, and he's been in and out of the criminal justice system. But it's had a huge impact on her life. So I think that if there isn't any legislation to deal with that, then that would be a big gap for me. And as I say, potentially could lead to homicide.
So specifically in the context of the domestic abuse bill, could you give any examples of how the inclusion of stalking within the particular context of domestic abuse and this bill might have some benefit, and perhaps include some examples of the link as you see them between stalking and domestic abuse and related offences?
Well, again, obviously my experience as a lawyer is in relation to England and Wales. But the way that the law is in England and Wales, the way it's worded, is that stalking is an offence that can happen after separation, can't happen during a relationship. During a relationship, that would be classified as coercive control. So stalking really is about the behaviour afterwards. And I noticed that within your domestic abuse bill, there is provision for prosecutions to take place for 10 years after separation. So if they've been in a relationship 10 years ago, up to 10 years ago, then I can see that your legislation can protect them. But it still doesn't name the problem, which is stalking. So I think many people will feel that it doesn't help them, because I think it's important that we help victims connect with the law by naming, you know, using the same words that they do for the problems that they're experiencing. And what we see with stalking, with it being about fixation and obsession, this is not something that stops 2 years, 3 years, even 10 years after separation. In many cases, it goes on for longer than that. So, you know, for your legislation to stop the protection at 10 years, I don't fully understand that. And I think that there would be a lot of, mainly women, because it does affect women more than men, that would fall outside of that and would be at risk if you don't include it.
Okay, so it's to do potentially with that post-separation behaviour and also helping victims name what's happening and more closely connect with the law. Thank you. And the next question is around stalking protection orders in terms of the UK. I'm not sure how long they've been a measure that's available for. Are there any issues that exist with them as you see them, or could they be improved?
We've only had them for a few weeks, so it really is too early to say. And I think the mission on the whole was quite brave and very different to many things that we've had before in England and Wales. So on the whole, I am in support of it. I am concerned that these protection orders may be used instead of prosecutions. And I think that would be a huge mistake, and potentially, again, would put victims at risk. By having a stalking protection order, it doesn't give the perpetrator a criminal conviction. They don't have a criminal record. So to some extent it becomes invisible. Clearly it will be on the police computer, but it can't be classified as a criminal record. And I think it's important that perpetrators are held to account with prosecutions and convictions. So I think they need to be used as well as convictions. And certainly in England and Wales, we have huge issues at the moment with bail, because bail was very much reduced a couple of years ago. So I think that these orders will plug the gap until the bail is hopefully changed back to offer more protection than the very short period it does at present, which tends to be around 28 days, which is not long enough. So I think they are useful. I think it's good that the breach of them is a criminal offence, because I think that is important. But like I say, I think it really is about the police using them in addition. And to some extent, I have seen cases with, obviously, I can't comment on current usage of these because they're too new. But in terms of the previous domestic violence protection orders we've had, I have seen several cases where they've been used instead of criminal prosecutions. And I do really think that would be a mistake. The current stalking protection orders as well only cover stalking. So in England and Wales, that wouldn't cover a situation where the parties have been in a relationship up to that point, because that behaviour wouldn't be classified as stalking. And I realise that in England and Wales, we are looking at bringing in a better domestic violence protection orders. But I would have liked to have seen them combined to some extent at this point, because the legislation is different. For example, on the stalking protection orders, the minimum period is 2 years. And I think that's really useful, because I think sometimes these orders are too short generally. If we look at things like non-molestation orders that are used in the family courts, they used to be granted when I first started practising. They were a different name, but they were only granted for 3 months, and it just wasn't long enough. Now, on average, I would say they're probably around 6 months. But really, I do think the minimum of 2 years is really useful, because it is a minimum. It can be longer. And I think it signifies the seriousness of this issue, and that it doesn't just go away overnight after separation. The domestic violence protection orders, as drafted in the bills, don't contain a minimum, and I do think that's a mistake.
Okay, thank you very much. In terms of the definition of stalking, could you make some comment as to whether it should be defined? Is it easy to define that behaviour?
Well, at Paladin, my charity, we have a definition that we work with, and I'll just give you that definition. It's a pattern of unwanted, fixated and obsessive behaviour which is intrusive and causes fear of violence or serious alarm or distress. Under English law, it isn't defined, and there was a lot of discussion at the time about whether it should be or shouldn't be, and I think it's right that it isn't defined, because otherwise it can't keep up with the changes in technology that stalkers use to carry out their behaviour. 10 years ago, the types of technology we're using were completely different to the ones we use now, and the ones that stalkers use now. I mean, we couldn't even comprehend 10, 15 years ago the types of technology, even like the smart heating type technology we have in our homes that are used by stalkers, smart TVs used by stalkers being able to switch on the camera on your mobile phone remotely so that they can actually see what you were doing and listen to what you were doing. I think 15 years ago, we would never have imagined that that was possible. So I think if we start to narrowly define stalking, it will be a mistake, and very quickly it will become out of date. And the other thing about it is that stalkers will look at that and will work their way around it. And really, we want the legislation to be as wide as possible to protect as many people as possible from, you know, this behaviour, which is very different in every case. Stalking is targeted against that victim, and they will target what that victim holds dear. So it will be very different for one person or another. It might be that somebody's, the main thing in their life is their job. The stalker will target their employment. I had a client once who said to me that she'd separated from a partner. She reported to me that she'd been to the police to report the fact. She was absolutely terrified. Her ex-partner, she felt, was stalking her. And the incident that made her terrified was the fact that she received through the post a brochure from the North Yorkshire Tourist Board. That was it. It just had her name and address on the envelope, and inside was that brochure. Most people would not be distressed by that, but for her, it meant so much. And with stalking, you have to look at the context to it, and you have to delve down into it rather than just looking at that specific incident in isolation. What that meant to her was very serious. Her ex-partner had been very violent to her all through their relationship. He had stalked her many times. He told her, if you ever leave me, I will find you, I will kill you, and I will bury you on the North Yorkshire Moors. And on the front of the brochure was the North Yorkshire Moors. So to her, that was a very clear threat to kill. And it had been sent to her from him. It also meant that he'd found her address. So without delving down into that, it may seem innocuous. And when she reported that to the police, you can imagine, unfortunately, she didn't get a very good response initially from it. It takes time sometimes to look at why victims are scared. So I think the more we define it, the fewer victims we will help. So I do think it's a mistake. I think what is important with all of this, with the whole domestic abuse bill, both with yourselves and in England and Wales, the most important thing is to dedicate resources to training. Because it doesn't matter how many laws we have, if the police and the judiciary and the CPS don't understand, of course they understand the law, but if they don't understand the dynamics of stalking, the dynamics of domestic abuse, and in particular, I think, coercive control and stalking, I think generally the police and judiciary, they do understand physical abuse now, and they understand that if somebody walks into a police station with a black eye, generally that will be taken seriously. It's the non-physical incidents, I think, which are treated far less seriously. They are completely minimised, and I think the risk is totally misunderstood. And actually, stalking and coercive control are the things that really we should be more worried about than the black eye. Because, you know, coercive control is 7 times more reliable as an indicator of homicide, of potential homicide, than physical abuse. So I feel that the whole system obsesses about physical abuse and totally ignores coercive control and stalking, and that's where we go wrong. And until we can get people within the criminal and family court system to understand that, then none of this will have any impact. You know, we do have stalking legislation in England and Wales, and it is being used to some extent, but it isn't being used anywhere near enough. And I think that's down in part to training and in part down to attitude with the police, because these crimes affect women way more than men, and I think that also needs to be recognised. You know, that it is a crime of misogyny quite often, and the impact on women is huge. You know, 2 women a week are still being murdered. That statistic hasn't changed over the last 30 years, yet we have put more resources into domestic abuse. We've had a raft of legislation, but that statistic remains the same. And my view is it's because people don't understand coercive control and stalking. You know, they are the real red flags, and nobody understands that.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. And then turning next to the specifics of the bill, how might Clause 5.1e be improved?
So I think I've partly mentioned this previously, haven't I? This is the section with regard to the connection between the people within a relationship. And within that, your legislation states that they will be connected people if they've been in a relationship within the last 10 years. Again, my issue would be, what happens if it was 11 years? Are we seriously going to say that that person is excluded from protection? And if somebody is still being stalked after 10 years, because that's what that behaviour is, I know you don't call it that, but they are being terrorised after separation. And at 11 years, we don't do anything about that. That can't be right. To me, that seems wrong. And I think it would put women at risk, you know, and men, but mainly women. And with stalking, it is not uncommon for these cases to go on for over 10 years. And I know that might feel, you know, so it beggars belief, but it's true. Stalking can go on for many years, usually because it's not being nipped in the bud and there hasn't been enough of a robust approach taken to it. But nonetheless, it does go on for over 10 years. And I think it would be wrong to exclude it there. And again, as I've said before, I do think it's important that we call it stalking. Because I think there is more of a connect then, not just for the victim to describe what's happening to them, but also for people like the police, you know, because at the end of the day, the police go out to these incidents, and we do criticise them a lot, but they have to deal, you know, with dozens and dozens of different crimes. Domestic abuse and stalking, coercive control is something that they will be dealing with a lot. So I think that, you know, there should be priority attached to training in relation to that. There's a call to the police, you know, in England every 30 seconds about domestic abuse. So it is something that we would be foolish not to put resources into.
Okay.
But for, I think it's wrong to exclude over 10 years.
Okay. And turning next to the patterns of behaviour, do you think the bill is sufficient in addressing patterns of behaviour, or could it be improved?
Well, obviously, the domestic abuse crime element doesn't mention pattern of behaviour. The way it's currently drafted would allow a one-off incident to be prosecuted. To me, domestic abuse is a pattern of behaviour. I don't think I've ever dealt with a case in over 20 years where there's just been one incident. Domestic abuse is a pattern, that's the essence of it. And certainly, you know, with coercive control, that is described as a pattern of behaviour. And I think that there's a risk if you don't ask for it to be made into a pattern of behaviour in law, there's a risk that these incidents will be dealt with in isolation, and that is a real problem. The stalking legislation in England requires more than one incident, because otherwise, all that we're doing is dealing with the individual incident, which on their own may seem like nothing. It might be classified often as criminal damage or different, usually quite low-level incidents. But it's only when we join them all together, at Paladin we call it joining the dots, and looking at them, not in isolation, but all together. And when you look at the totality of the behaviour, then you really get a flavour for the impact on the victim and the total obsession and obsessive nature of the perpetrator. And only then will it be taken seriously. Because if you prosecute incidents in isolation, you just don't get the impact of the reality of the situation for the victim. There will be incidents every day or several times a day. And to just pick one out in isolation, I think, misses the point.
Okay, thank you. Turning now to a matter to do with cross-examination, based on your experience, do you have any comment on clause 43 and 44 in respect of cross-examination?
Yes, and, you know, I have similar comments about the bill in England and Wales. This is a real problem, particularly in the family courts, with victims being cross-examined by perpetrators about sexual offences which the victim alleges that the perpetrator has carried out against them. Can you imagine anything worse than being cross-examined in detail about, you know, the detail of a rape by your rapist? To me, it's almost as bad as the rape itself. You're putting the victim through another ordeal. And I think giving evidence in court in any situation is stressful. But to give evidence about that type of incident, when your perpetrator is sat in front of you and is not only sat in front of you but asking you the questions, I think it's a horrific prospect. And it, you know, it does need to change. Quite rightly, this bill does attempt to change that. I say attempt because, again, with just like the one in England, there's too many provisos with it, in my view, that if they've got an injunction in England or if they've got a conviction or a caution, then it can't happen. Otherwise, it's very much discretionary. Well, we've had a discretionary bar already. Judges can prevent it from happening and often do prevent it from happening now, but not always. And the problem is, this is why we need the legislation, to legislate for the judges that don't see it as a problem and that continue to allow this to happen. Because if judges use their discretion, in my view, correctly, and viewed it for the serious thing that it is, it wouldn't be happening at all. We wouldn't need this legislation. So to me, I would prefer to see it drafted in the way that if an allegation has been made, there shouldn't have been any cross-examination at all by the alleged perpetrator. It just shouldn't happen. And again, my fear around this is that, you know, if we've got a case where there's been physical violence or very serious sexual violence, it will happen less often. But when we've got cases where the allegations are around stalking or coercive control, that just isn't seen as serious by many judges. And I think that that will fall through the net unless it's changed in terms of how it's drafted.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to try and get through the rest of the questions because I'm conscious that we've got another person that we're hearing from at 11:15, and I want to make sure that this committee covers as much as it can do this morning. I'll move on to the next question now, which is, do you have any insight on the prevalence of an appropriate legal intervention for behaviour which might be classed as domestic abuse for those under age 16?
Yeah, age 16 domestic abuse is something that people didn't really think about until quite recently. And studies have shown that it is far more prevalent than we imagine, and happening more and more. And I think that, again, technology plays a big part in this. I think when, you know, teenagers at school start dating, there's an expectation now that the girl will send her boyfriend a naked picture of herself, and that is almost the norm now. And then obviously that can be used to control her in different ways, with threats of sending it round, showing it to the parents, that kind of thing, putting it on the internet, which happens all the time. You know, the age of criminal responsibility is 10. I don't see why it should be any different in a domestic abuse situation. So, you know, I would encourage, I think it's the stalking protection orders that don't cover under 18s, and I think I think they should, because I don't see a distinction between any other crime.
Do you think that the notices and orders that are present in this bill should therefore apply to under 16s then, as a way of protection alongside the offence also applying potentially?
Yeah, I think the stalking protection orders should be used, because, you know, there's no reason not to. They aren't even, they don't even give the defendant a criminal conviction. So to me, there's absolutely no reason why they shouldn't be used at all.
Okay. And moving on to the approach that's known as Clare's Law, which is Clause 45 in our bill. Are there alternatives to this approach that might have better impact, in your view?
Yes, I think that I think the right to ask isn't enough, and I think there needs to be a requirement on the police to tell. And whilst Clare's Law does allow the police to tell, it doesn't place a requirement on them. By the time somebody is contacting the police and asking for information about their partner, it's too late, because it means they've already experienced abuse, in my view. What we need to do is make sure that the police are going out there. Sorry. And that the police are actually telling these women about the risks that they're placed at. And the history that their partner has.
Okay, thank you very much. Moving to the wider context now, you obviously had a lot of experience to do with the UK bill. This is still a bill over there. It's not been progressed. Could you comment on the UK bill, and were there aspects that you hoped would go further or that you perhaps consider are not ideal?
Yes, absolutely. Lots of things that I think could have been in it. I'll try and be as quick as possible. We were disappointed that there was no serial perpetrators register. It's something that Paladin have campaigned for, and it was recommended that it should be in the bill. This would place serial perpetrators of stalking and domestic abuse on the similar register to sex offenders, because stalkers and domestic abuse perpetrators tend to be serial perpetrators. They don't just stop. They will go on and find the next victim and the next victim. So we think that is really important, and we were disappointed about that. I also think that it's bizarre that we don't have any crime, hate crime and misogyny. We have hate crimes against race, religion, sexuality, but, you know, you can be as awful as you like about women because they are women, and nothing happens. And this is a crime that's on the increase. You only have to go on Twitter as a woman to see that. There are certain police forces, like Nottingham, who have trialled that, but there isn't any... It's not an aggravating factor, and it isn't a hate crime. So I think that was a missed opportunity. I also think there needs to be more recognition around the fact that domestic abuse itself is an act of misogyny, and that particular coercive control. Dr. Evan Stark, who invented the term coercive control, you know, actually said that it was something used by men against women, and men used their position in society to it enabled them to do it effectively. And that it was a component of coercive control, but that seems to have been lost, really. So I think that would be a shame. As I mentioned before, there needs to be compulsory training. Otherwise, these bills will not have the effect that we want. There needs to be training for the police, the CPS, the judiciary, both in the criminal courts and the family courts. Otherwise, nothing will change. In my view, we need to see much more robust sentences. It's a fact still that stranger crime, a stranger assault, is sentenced far more robustly than a domestic abuse assault, when it should be the reverse, because actually it is an aggravating factor that it's a breach of trust in a domestic abuse relationship. I also think there needs to be an overhaul in relation to the family courts and a presumption against contact where there are allegations of domestic violence until it's fully investigated. And again, I think CAFC has to need to be included in that list of people who need training on coercive control and domestic abuse. I could go on, but I know you press for time, but I would say they are my highlights, but there are lots. It wasn't the bill it was promised to be.
Okay, thank you very much, Rachel. I will just ask one final question. Is there anything else that you would wish to bring to the attention of this council, aside from what you've already highlighted, to aid our consideration and the ultimate impact of this legislation, especially in terms of protecting victims?
I mean, I won't repeat the things I've already said, because I think a lot of those are relevant. I would actually consider things like revenge porn. I don't know if you have legislation in respect of that. Things like what are colloquially referred to as upskirting, where photographs are taken of women's skirts and then published on the internet quite often. I think that's a huge factor. But again, I would say I think you do need an offensive toolkit. And the only other thing I would say is the training element. Everything will fail without it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mrs. Lord Brennan. I'll give honourable members an opportunity in the few minutes we have left to put a question to the witness. I'll start with the mover of the bill, Ms. August Hanson.
Thank you very much. And I will come to a question, but just as a brief outline, we are looking at stalking offences at the moment in terms of Home Affairs here on the Isle of Man. It's due to go into the justice reform legislation. We also have a sex offences piece that's coming forward as well, which updates the 2003 legislation from the UK, which includes things like upskirting and revenge porn, as it's put as well. It's a popular term. What I'm wondering is something that I think that perhaps a lot of Legislative Council members have made mention of. Do you think that it's appropriate to put stalking into this piece of legislation when, you have stalkers that perhaps are... are not personally connected and have never been personally connected to the victim?
I think the way that the legislation is drafted would have... obviously, I've not seen a stalking bill. Certainly, the way that coercive control, domestic abuse and stalking are defined within England and Wales, there's a clear cut-off point. Stalking starts at separation. The same behaviour before, during a relationship, would be coercive control. And I think the way that the domestic abuse bill you have is drafted confuses that to some extent in terms of the way it's understood, certainly, in other jurisdictions, because it allows the domestic abuse prosecution to go on for up to 10 years. I'm not sure why it was settled on 10 years, but there is some confusion there. So it would make sense, in my view, to put it in, because these, even the stranger stalking work tends to be done hand in hand with domestic abuse services. Within the police, it will be the police officer that deals with stranger stalking and domestic abuse stalking. And two-thirds of stalking is domestic abuse related anyway. So I think to kind of have a completely separate bill just in relation to stranger stalking, to me, there's no need for that. I would put them in the same place, but obviously that's a matter for you.
Thank you very much. Mrs. Poole-Wilson?
Yes, thank you very much, Ms. Horman. Just one question on cross-examination provisions. You said you were concerned that there's too many restrictions and there's too much discretion, I think you said. Do you have any view on, in our bill, we say that discretion can be exercised to prevent cross-examination by the individual where the court believes there's significant distress condition will be met. Do you have any view on whether outlining in detail in guidance the sorts of things that the court should bear in mind when assessing that would assist the judiciary to make the best decisions about not allowing cross-examination, understanding what significant distress looks like and where it can come from to pick up the issue of coercive control as well as physical abuse?
Well, it should do, but from my own experience in England and Wales, it doesn't. We have Practice Direction 12J in the Family Court, which sets down detailed guidance around coercive control and how family cases should be dealt with. That is routinely ignored. So my concern would be that, again, if you leave it to discretion, it will continue to be ignored. If it's brought in with compulsory in-depth training for all judiciary, then perhaps, but certainly if you compare it to similar guidance in England and Wales, if you allow it to fall to discretion, it won't happen.
One final last question, Mrs. Masker.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you, Rachel. It's been very helpful. I don't know if you're aware, but we have no homelessness legislation on the Isle of Man. And I wonder how aspects of our legislation relating to domestic abuse and suitable protective accommodation, how important might that be in supporting victims that are in a vulnerable position given their accommodation?
Extremely important, particularly for women. Women are classified in England and Wales as homeless if they are suffering domestic abuse, so it enables them to get, I'm not saying it's a magic wand, but they certainly get to the top of the list. It assists them in obtaining housing, so I think that that is vital because, you know, women just won't report and won't leave if they've nowhere to go. It's okay setting in motion prosecutions, etc., but where is the woman going to live? Refuge provision is still not adequate enough, certainly in England and Wales. I would imagine you have a similar issue. It seems to be the case everywhere. So I think that these fundamental things are really important because we've got to think about the practical effects on victims and can they afford to live? Do they have somewhere to live? I would also like to see more use of councils and housing associations evicting perpetrators. In England and Wales, they have the ability to do that under the tenancies. They hardly ever use it, and they expect victims to go out and get their own court orders, which is wrong.
Thank you. Ms. Horman, I would like to thank you very much for giving your evidence to Legislative Council this morning. It's been most helpful, and we're most grateful to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting me.